Welcome to Let's Talk Memoir, a podcast for memoir lovers, readers, and writers. I'm your host, Ronit Plank. Today, my guest is Anne Batchelder, who is the author of Craving Spring, A Mother's Quest, A Daughter's Depression, and The Greek Myth That Brought Them Together. After earning a master's degree in social work, Anne worked in business, education, and the arts. She was the acting director of the International Studies Program at Lesley University, the director of special events at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, and for 10 years served as editor of Fiber Arts Magazine. As a guest curator for the Asheville Art Museum, she designed and developed three major contemporary art exhibitions featuring artists such as Louise Bourgeois, Anne Hamilton, Sally Mann, Maya Lin, and Laurie Anderson. Welcome, Anne.
Thank you.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm so happy to be here.
Me too. I'm so glad you're here. Can you share a bit about your new book, Craving Spring, and a bit about how you incorporate the theme of Demeter and Persephone in it?
Sure. The story is about a woman's desperate attempt to rescue her teenage daughter who struggles with depression and addiction, and how a Greek myth helps her transition from mothering a troubled teen to guiding a resilient young adult. But it's also about honesty, compassion, trust, and how stories can help us rescue ourselves. Mm-hmm. So when my daughter was battling with an eating disorder in high school in around 2010, one day in therapy, I was talking about how frantic I felt, and my therapist said, "Oh, you're just like Demeter, you know, the goddess whose daughter is captured by Hades and dragged to the underworld." And Demeter becomes distraught, and she refuses to sleep or eat or perform her duties until her daughter is returned. Well, I didn't read the myth for a long time, but once I did, all these light bulbs went off in my head. I totally identified with Demeter, and I began to question our culture's understanding of motherhood. And years later, during the pandemic, when I started shaping my memoir, I knew I wanted to incorporate this story somehow, but I didn't understand how I was going to do it. So at first I considered including Homer's myth as an introductory chapter, because I realized a lot of people weren't familiar with the myth. Mm-hmm. But the more I thought about it, the more I wanted to offer my interpretation, how I saw Demeter. Mm-hmm. And then as I dug further, I realized the arc of the myth was similar to my experience. And that's when I decided to weave the chapters about Demeter in parallel with my story. And once I had that structure, the book sort of fell into place.
Okay. So I'm curious how much, if you can remember or, you know, reflect on how much material you had already or didn't have this idea when you came upon this idea to incorporate the myth.
Throughout the problems that my daughter was having with depression and addiction, I journal a lot because that's how I think. That's how I process. Mm-hmm. And so once that writing started becoming a little more descriptive, I started taking classes and workshops. And then I had a lot of material together. And then I think it was during the pandemic that I got serious about creating a book. And so I had all these pieces of writing, but they weren't together at all. They were just all over the place, including journals and everything else. And one day I took myself off for a week by myself and just ate and slept and wrote. You know, I'd stay up till 3 a.m. if I felt like it or whatever, and kind of mapped out everything and kind of looked at the arc of the Demeter story and then started writing chapters for the Demeter story. And once I did that, I think it was all during the pandemic, all during that time, and especially during that week when I was gone, I sort of figured out what the story arc was going to be for both of my experience as well as Demeter's experience, or my interpretation of Demeter's experience. And that's, it just sort of had all this material at one place, and then I just kind of figured it out.
And I'm curious about the reception in your writing groups, or if you worked with any editors, how they received the idea of incorporating the myth. Did you have any kind of template for it, or did you feel worried about it at all? Or once you had it, was it pretty seamless for you?
You know, I didn't have a writing group per se. I would take a class, or I did have an editor at one point during the pandemic. I sort of asked her what she thought of this. She thought it was a great idea, and she was actually suggested that I think I had maybe 3 or 4 of the Demeter chapters, and she said, why don't you put some more in? Mm. And so kind of pepper your book with this throughout, instead of just 3 or 4 chapters. So that was sort of helpful. And then the reception overall was good. The only thing I was really worried about was, who am I to reinterpret this myth? And I talked with someone who is a classics professor, and she reassured me that the myth has been interpreted for centuries, and that, you know,
I can see that. I totally can see feeling that way. Like, you know, why I'm just a human. This is about a goddess and her goddess daughter, and how can I use it in my story? But I think that's true, that there are archetypes that people turn to again and again.
Well, right. And I was reading something that Pema Chodron had written about how we're all myth makers. I mean, we're all telling our stories in a way, so that I wasn't trying to be a scholar about Demeter. I was more using the myth as a jumping point for my interpretation of myself.
Well, also, like, that's a really good point you make, too, about interpreting yourself through that, because that's really what we do as memoirists, is shine a stronger light or dig around in there, within ourselves, to figure out how things happen, why we saw it the way and experienced the way we did, and what we make of it now. And you're looking at yourself through this lens and kind of superimposing Demeter onto it and all that. And what was the reaction in your family when you began working in earnest on a memoir about what you had experienced?
I didn't talk to them about it. I decided not to share that until I was done. Mm-hmm. I mean, I really didn't. I mean, they knew I was writing a story. They knew, everybody knew kind of what it was about, but I didn't want to have that kind of influence on what I was writing. I didn't expect to publish this book initially. Mm. I was just putting it together to try to understand myself. Mm. And so once I decided to actually make a book, once the final manuscript got done, then I let my family read what I had, and especially my daughter, and let her decide whether she was comfortable with it, whether she wanted me to eliminate anything, or whether she was okay with having me publish it, and she was. So.
Mm-hmm. And can I ask how long in the past, I guess, you know, your book ends at a certain point, how many years from the end point of the book was the writing of the book? Like, how much time has passed in between the experience you talk about and the book?
Probably, well, as I said, I was journaling a lot off and on, but crafting the book itself and deciding to write a book didn't really happen until just before the pandemic. So it would probably be about 6 years after my daughter was already in recovery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm curious about, you know, you'd spend some time talking about addiction and Al-Anon and what you discovered as a mom. And I pulled this quote where you write, "Addiction I had come to understand is a hunger of the soul, a disconnect with the natural flow of life, the terror of loneliness, the tyranny of expectations, the fear that something is wrong with us, and the loss of faith. All this feeds into the desire for escape, the need to lessen the pain. I too had a hunger, a confusion and longing within me, and I was trying to fill it by thinking I could be the perfect mom." I'm wondering, Anne, where you feel you've landed in your approach to mothering now, and how has sharing your memoir with readers impacted your understanding of this experience of maternal guilt or the inadequacy moms can feel?
Mm-hmm. When I was writing the book, I wanted to unravel where my assumptions and attitudes about motherhood originated. So I was influenced by my mother, of course, but I realized these ideas were embedded in the history of women in our culture. And yet, Demeter was different. Here was a powerful Greek goddess who felt completely helpless when her daughter was captured. At the same time, she demanded results and refused to give up. Yet nobody called her a helicopter mom or a codependent. You know, in a way, the myth was vindicating for me and showed me how natural it was for a mother to be consumed with fear and anger when her child is in danger. But the more I read the myth, the more I realized that Demeter also had to learn how to compromise, how to let go, how to return to herself. And this was the transformation that many women don't do, I feel. They often get stuck in feeling out of control or needing everything to work out for their kids. They feel guilty or worried that they aren't perfect because we do such a good job in our country of blaming mothers who either do too little or too much. And there's no compassion when the expectation is to be perfect.
Right.
So Demeter was far from perfect, but she also had to evolve and learn how to change. And this was something I really wanted to convey in the book, that progress or recovery is not a straight line, and accepting our humanness is a huge part of healing. And as a mother, I now understand how to trust my intuition, yet challenge myself to grow. So it's
important.
That's
tough. I mean, that's really tough to, you know, trust your intuition, but challenge yourself to grow.
Took me a long time. It's important to stay centered because motherhood changes. We go through many stages. A lot of people, I think, focus on pregnancy and early childhood, and then you get to be about, your kids are like teenagers, and people aren't talking anymore about, okay, what's the next stage after that of motherhood, and what's the next stage after that? So I think we're evolving into talking about those kind of transitions more.
Yeah, no, I think that's very useful. And I do think there's a push-pull, at least for me, between intuition and challenging myself, like sticking to what I know and what I want and what I feel, and also knowing that I might be capable of more, or that I'm allowed to change, or that I can lean into that too.
Exactly.
I was wondering if you would read that excerpt we talked about, and you can set it up however you like.
I think it's pretty self-explanatory. I'll just start reading. I dutifully began attending Al-Anon. Every Thursday evening at a Presbyterian church in West Asheville, I went to a meeting for parents whose children were dealing with addiction. The first night I walked into the musty basement of that church, I wondered if I would have anything in common with the people there. Then across the room, I recognized an old friend. Our eyes locked, but she said nothing. Instead, she stood up, walked over to me, hugged me, and then went back to her seat. I forced myself not to cry or turn around and leave the room. I didn't want a hug, and I didn't want to belong to this group. Now someone knew that our family had a problem, that my daughter was an addict, and I didn't want this to be happening. I figured I'd stay long enough to hear what they had to say, learn how to help Olivia, and be done with it. Then a father, whose teenage son had just been arrested, read a tedious list of rules and introduced a topic for discussion. Each group member sitting around the long wooden table was given a chance to share their thoughts or pass. I stayed quiet, trying not to look at anyone. Most of the stories here are much worse than mine, I smugly noted. Still, I was worried. At the end of the meeting, we all stood up, held hands, and said the Serenity Prayer, something about accepting what we cannot control. The leader encouraged everyone to keep coming back. As we filed toward the door, several parents were laughing, smiling, or hugging each other. I hunched on my coat, kept my head down, and walked quickly through the dark parking lot to my car. I hadn't laughed in a long time, I realized, and I didn't sing anymore. I wanted what they had, but I didn't have the faintest idea how to get it. Although Al-Anon stressed that parents didn't cause and can't cure addiction, I wasn't so sure. Whenever I worried aloud to friends that I might be to blame for Olivia's problems, they were quick to be supportive. Oh, you did the best you could, they'd say. This only made me furious. To me, that line always sounded like a cheap attempt to wipe away parental sins. At least if I was partially to blame, I reasoned, I was also powerful enough to save her. My need for my daughter to get better followed me like a vapor. It hid in my bed and seeped into my clothes, weighing me down under a sea of sadness. Now and then I'd catch the sweet scent of hope before it vanished, but mostly the vapor was putrid. Sometimes it smelled sharp and rancid, like the time a mouse died in our wall behind the TV. Sometimes it was sour or stale, like rotting food, a reminder of my daughter's gradual decline. I was always on edge because I knew I was smelling death. At any moment, Olivia could overdose. she could die. Olivia was still in college and attending AA meetings, but I could tell she was fragile and struggling. Every time she went into a tailspin on the phone with me, I wrote it right along with her. I was not detached or immune to emotional entanglements with my child the way our Al-Anon leaders encouraged us to be. I was not clean. I had a burning desire to play a significant role in saving her. I wanted redemption for my failure to protect her, and I would stop at nothing until I satisfied those cravings. More than simply obsessed about my daughter's recovery, I became addicted to it.
Thank you. That was something that I hadn't considered before I read this section, that what your need was and driven so much by, maybe would you say a compulsion to make everything better and protect her, that became that kind of addictive relationship. And did your, I mean, maybe this is too private and please tell me if I shouldn't ask, but did your husband, did he have any of that compulsion?
Well, not the same way I did. I mean, his was different. He was anxious and concerned, and of course, and wanted to help her. But I think for me, it was more this sense of mother failure that mm-hmm. I had. I mean, he felt that too. He did feel that as well. But I think I was more driven about it, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, you depict those meetings with your is it a sponsor for Al-Anon as well?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you depict those scenes where your sponsor, who's been through this for longer, really kind of calls you on your behavior and points out to you where you are kind of getting hooked in there. And I'm wondering how you relate to all of this now. I mean, you write later, you know, you write in the book, I didn't trust my children to have their own problems and solutions, their own destinies. I assumed it was up to me to keep them from the dark waters of life. And I mean, I relate to that. I have two kids, mm-hmm. A little bit different in age difference than yours. But what is it like for you now between trust and letting go? And how do you and your children navigate that?
Mm-hmm. At first, I didn't understand what it meant to let go. I thought it meant I had to abandon my daughter, especially when you're dealing with someone who's, has problems and suffering from addiction. But eventually, through years of therapy and mindfulness study and the process of writing this book, I understood that what I had to let go of was my fear. You don't just let go of something and stay empty. You have to replace it with something. And I think what you replace it with, what we talked about earlier, was confidence and trusting your intuition. So I had to trust that I was also part of a bigger picture of life, and that my daughter's process was also part of that bigger picture. In other words, I wasn't the one totally responsible. She had a role in her own recovery. Mm-hmm. So I could offer support while honoring her ability to find her own way. And it didn't happen overnight. It took a lot of practice, and I'm still practicing. I don't think it's something we ever just do. It's not a one and done thing.
Yeah. And also, you talk a bit about your background with your mom. So there really is this mother's story here, because the reader learns a bit about how you were raised, how you tried to do differently with your children, what happened to your daughter, and this cycle, which of course also reflects the Demeter Persephone story. And I think, I mean, I remember being in grade school and studying the myths, and that one was one of my very favorites. I mean, of course I have a strong mother-daughter background as well. I mean, we all do, but you know, anyone who's had any type of rupture in their family might find the Demeter Persephone myth to be particularly resonant. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what drew me to your memoir, because I thought, yeah, I mean, I was so invested in that story and so sad when, you know, Persephone couldn't go back full time with her mom.
Right.
The way you frame it now, that Demeter had to learn how to compromise and how to be, to trust a little bit that her daughter would be okay and wasn't just a victim, you know, and I know I'm summarizing it, there's more to it than that, is a new way for me to perceive that.
Yeah, it's interesting, because most memoirs that I've come across about mother-daughter relationships have to do with the daughter's perspective, or many of them do. Mm-hmm. And especially when it comes to writing about addiction, it's often about that. I wanted to tell the story from the mother's perspective about what it felt like as a mom mm-hmm. to have to mm-hmm. go through that separation and that fear mm-hmm. and what I had to learn to reconnect with my child.
Mm-hmm. Right, on new terms, totally mm-hmm. different than what you knew, which is so hard to break patterns. What, on a craft level, challenged you, if anything, about the memoir? Were there parts of the memoir writing craft that took more time or that you had to untangle more than others? Or can you talk a little bit about the process of writing it beyond the structure that you discovered?
It was like wrestling with an alligator. I just felt like I had, everything was swirling for a long time. And it wasn't until I could focus in on what I was trying to say. I thought I was going to be writing about my daughter's experience. What it was like to be the mom of a girl who, you know, had depression and addiction. And the more I wrote about it, the more I realized it was about me. Mm-hmm. And then once I realized that, I got much more interested in where did these assumptions come from and where, you know, what in my background brought me to this conclusion. And so I think it was just an unraveling that took a while for mm-hmm. me to understand what the point of the book was.
Mm-hmm. Was that frustrating? And did you discover that on your own, or did someone point out to you that, well, actually you should spend more time focused on your process and growth?
No, I figured it out myself. I didn't have a lot of
You mentioned you didn't have guidance. Like a writing.
No,
yeah.
I didn't. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a lot of guidance. I just sort of buried myself in it for a couple of years and came out.
Yeah, I think that's so true. I just love how we're kind of circling back to this idea that it's not just the story of what happened with somebody. It's our experience of what we went through with that person and what it means about us, or what we went through wherever we were, and mm-hmm. how we changed or how we were impacted by it. That's so important, because it's not just, oh, this person in my life and I, we had this thing.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I think it's interesting to me, because I feel like memoirs have become so popular because people want, they want a story that's true, that's real, that so that they can understand that it's possible for them to also overcome whatever difficulties they're going through too.
I think so. Yeah, and I think that we're rooting, I think as readers, whether we are aware of it or not, at least for me, so I won't speak for everyone, I'm rooting for the memoirist mm-hmm. to find their way or to have clarity about what it is that they're wrestling with.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I want them to. And when I see it as a reader, but my memoirist who I'm reading, the memoirist, doesn't seem to be aware of it. And it's sort of like, over there, just look over there, it's right there. And then you want them to pick it up and look at it and get closer and try to sort of unpack it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So at the end of your memoir, your daughter has a section that she wrote. So she writes about 3 or 4 paragraphs at the end. That's part of your book. That's the end. And so here is the quote that I pulled that was written by Olivia. "It wasn't always easy growing up in our family. Everyone was successful, and I felt a lot of pressure. Sometimes I just wanted an escape. When I got too deep into drugs, I knew I needed to change, but I didn't know how. Having my parents' support was crucial to my recovery. It also helped when Mom took responsibility for her actions without blaming herself. It was hard enough trying to stay in control of my feelings. I couldn't handle worrying about hers too." So, very powerful, and I'm wondering how including her voice came to be mm-hmm. and what it was like for you to understand what she shared there.
Yeah, after she read the final version of my manuscript, I was very nervous while she was reading it, of course. And she looked up and said, "This is a love letter to me, isn't it?" And I knew then that she would be okay with me publishing it. Mm-hmm. And that's when I asked her if she'd like to write the epilogue. And I have to admit, I was taken back a bit by her honesty, but she was right. My willingness to accept responsibility without shame was ultimately what allowed us to grow closer. And I credit the Demeter myth with giving me permission to do that. It's what ultimately brought us together. So mm-hmm. the more we can share our stories of self-discovery, what I call women's wisdom, the more we can reduce the stigma around mental health issues and the need to be the perfect mother.
It's hard. It's painful to go back. Even when I think about the mistakes I've made, my kids, I always say it on this program, but at the time of this recording, 18 and 16. And, you know, sometimes I think back when I was a younger mom, where I feel like I can see more clearly maybe some mistakes or things I would like to do differently. Some of them are very basic, like maybe actually doing something physical and, you know, they slipped or they got hurt and I should have done something different. These days, I'm not totally as clear. Sometimes I see the mistakes I'm making, and later on in the future, I'll probably have more clarity about that. But it is really hard as a parent to not feel bad about the mistakes you make, because you feel like you're charged with this giant responsibility and you love the children so much. Like, how do you keep making mistakes?
It's so hard. And yet part of admitting mistakes is what models for our children how you handle that and what you do with it.
As opposed
to pretending to be perfect.
Of course, it's so important, especially like it's a good analogy because I like to do that in my writing when I'm writing about personal things, how I'm really feeling. And it's important to share with our children what our thinking is about this. And there's this quote, this last quote that I wanted to share, which you write, "Regret became a temporary solution to a long-term problem. It kept me focused on all that went wrong, all that could have been, and all that was lost. If I immersed myself in regret, I could ignore the fear at the bottom of my heart, the secret that I might still be inadequate." And that's where you write, "I became a junkie for regret." So how is your level of regret now? How did writing your memoir impact your sense of regret?
Writing the memoir was really important to me to understand how to let go, and specifically of staying in the present moment rather than regretting the past or worrying about the future. I could see as I wrote how my assumptions about myself being at fault was like a drug. It gave me a sense of control in an uncontrollable situation. But my obsession or craving for my daughter to be happy wasn't helping her. Once I realized this, it was easier to let it go. If I was going to be a more effective parent rather than try to fix her problems, I had to learn to support her through her recovery.
And, you know, when you ended up going to those Al-Anon meetings, I understand the way that you write the scene. It's this sense I think that maybe many of us would have, which is, I never thought I'd be here.
Oh,
I never thought I'd find myself here. This is for other people.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you know, I remember my husband and I went to a wedding one time, and we were talking with another couple. This is early on when Olivia was still in early high school. And the couple, I said, "Well, so where are your children?" And the couple, the man said, "Oh, well, my daughter and her boyfriend live in our basement right now because they're recovering heroin addicts." And I my jaw just dropped, and I turned around and went off and got another drink. You know, I just sort of, and I said to my husband afterwards, it's like, "Can you imagine what that would be like?" I can imagine. And then a couple of years later, we were at another wedding, and he was there. It was the same family, different daughter, so that couple was there again. And I walked up to the man and I said, "I didn't understand what you were talking about before, but my daughter is in recovery now." And he just didn't say a word. He just came up and gave me a big hug. And I realized compassion is what we need. When we think, "Oh, it could never happen to us," or "I don't know how I would do that," it's surprising, but things happen, and you're not prepared for it, and you just have to deal with it when it happens.
I think we can all relate to that. I'm thinking of a lot of examples that have happened to me, not about this particular parenting or childhood issue, but other things where I thought I was immune, and then I experienced it.
Right.
Yeah, compassion. So what advice would you like to share with writers who are working on their memoirs?
I suppose everyone's different, but what helped me was to, you've heard the expression, dance like no one's looking. Like.
Yeah.
Well, I my feeling was write like no one's reading. To write your raw experiences first, and then in revision, pretend the book is a movie and focus on how you want to move from one scene to the next, and focus on the action, and choose where you want to insert your questions or backstory, but don't get caught in the weeds of reflection too early, because I think that basically what people want to read is a story.
You know? And were there memoirs that were helpful to you as you wrote yours, or ones that have since become really important to you?
I love memoirs and journals from an early age. I was influenced by The Diary of an Ice Nin and Mae Sarton's journal, things like that. But when my daughter was deep in her depression and active addiction, which was about 2010 to 2014, I read books like Beautiful Boy or Wild or Another Bullshit Night in Suck City or Glass Castle or The Tinder Bar, things like that that mm-hmm. I could relate to. And then later, I loved H is for Hawk. And mm-hmm. I was also reading a lot of books about Buddhism, Pema Chodron or Tara Brach. And then there was another book that was called Eating in the Light of the Moon by a psychologist named Anita Johnston, who grew up in a Pacific Island culture that values indigenous storytelling as a path toward healing. So those are the kinds of things that I think really influenced me at the time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'm going to put all of those titles in the show notes. And lastly, where can people find you if they want to learn more about your work and your book?
Best place is my website, www.annbatchelder.com. And I'm also on Facebook and Instagram.
Okay. Thank you so much for sharing your story and spending time with me today. I really loved learning more about your writing process and how you are now.
Well, thank you, Ronit. It's been a delight.
Thank you for tuning in to Let's Talk Memoir. For more about this episode and my guest, please visit the link in the show notes or on Instagram at Ronit Plank. That's RonitPlank. You can also follow me on Twitter, Facebook, and TikTok. If you liked this episode of Let's Talk Memoir, please go ahead and share it with your friends and subscribe. And if you have 2 more seconds, you can rate and review it on Apple Podcasts, which really does help other people find the show. Thank you so much for being here.